It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it might be hard to think about, but our next guest says taking a moment to go through what you do in an active shooter situation could help save your life.
First, we're taking a look at what role Wisconsin is expected to play in the Republican primary. Even though Wisconsin is the 33rd state on the primary election calendar, our state could still make a difference when it comes to choosing the Republican candidate.
Susan Johnson is with us. She's the Assistant Dean and Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in Wisconsin, we've got a big progressive history, a lot of famous Democrats, also the state where the Republican Party was founded in part. How have we typically gone in presidential elections in the past?
Well, in the past few presidential elections, as we know, the Wisconsin voters have supported the Democratic candidate. So for our most recent history, it's gone Democratic. But then, as we also know, in those midterm elections, the state has voted very strongly the other direction, and we've elected a lot of Republicans.
Now, dialing into the primary, it happens a lot, it seems like, where Wisconsin doesn't matter. By the time it comes to us this year, it'll be April 5th. Everything's done. Everything's decided. Could that be different this time around?
You know, everything is different this time around. And it's really hard to make a fair assessment. My gut still tells me that the pool is going to whittle down to the point where by the time we get to April, it's probably going to be done, but I'm not making any big wagers on that.
Right, because this is unprecedented in some ways with the number in particular of Republican candidates. We don't have a lot to go on to predict how that's going to winnow out down the road.
Right, and we've not had this many candidates this late. It's still early, but this late in the process who are, you know, still in it. And still we've got another debate tonight, so we'll see if maybe that leads to a little bit more winnowing. But this is a unique situation.
So on the Republican side in particular, obviously we had a Wisconsin candidate, Scott Walker, who, if he had stuck around in the race, might have hoped for a bump when he got to Wisconsin. Assuming the race still matters, are there candidates that seem poised to take the support he might have gotten?
I think what was interesting is that when Governor Walker withdrew from the race, he made a bit of a veiled comment that people should not be going in Trump's direction. And yet what we saw in the most recent Marquette poll that was done at the in September is that a lot of those voters seem to actually do the opposite of what Governor Walker suggested. And in that poll, Donald Trump moved to first place. And then Ben Carson, the other person who's leading nationally as well, was up there. And then Marco Rubio was 14%. I still think that the Trump support and the Carson support is going to go down. We have already begun to see that with Donald Trump. So Marco Rubio, from what I understand, seems to have the support of what we would refer to as, I guess, the establishment Republican Party in Wisconsin and has made a lot of connections that way. So I would think that maybe he'd stand to benefit if the race is still going on in April.
Wisconsin is different than some other primary and caucus states. Iowa, of course, has its caucuses. Some states you have to be a registered member of a party to vote in that party. We've got that open primary. You can show up at the polls, pick a party, and vote in it. Does that affect the dynamic of how a candidate runs in a state like Wisconsin?
I think that we hear lots of stories about people who are of the other party going in and crossing party lines to vote in primaries, but I think that's a lot more legend than it is factual evidence where we've seen that actually sway an election one way or the other. What it does do is in some states you're required to have registered with the party in order to even vote. And so what it does allow is for people who are not registered to vote and also not members of the party, obviously, to just come in on election day and cast their ballot, which is different from how other primaries are run in some other states. So that might make a difference. If we get some energy behind a particular candidate, you could see increases for that candidate based on voter mobilization closer to the primary.
We're talking to Susan Johnson, political science professor at UW-Whitewater. Republican debate tonight. We're looking ahead at whether Wisconsin's primary in April is going to matter. Now, I wonder, people sometimes say Iowa being first, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, it skews the way candidates talk about the issues because they're trying to get those primary or caucus voters in those states behind them. Do you see that? Do you see it skewing the way issues rise in presidential politics?
Oh, I think it absolutely does. And it's one of the reasons why the support for corn subsidies had been such an important issue in presidential politics, and that's because of Iowa being the first in the nation and then also obviously being a significant producer of corn. So I think clearly that matters. I think that also, aside from the issues, you have the type of electorate that is present in these early primary and caucus states. So again, using Iowa as an example, Iowa Republicans tend to be much more evangelical and much more conservative than you would say the nation as a whole, as far as Republicans go. And that makes a difference in terms of how the candidates have to pitch themselves to that voter base. And with the Democrats, the Iowa base tends to actually be a bit more liberal than nationwide. So it's an interesting dynamic. And obviously, New Hampshire and South Carolina have their own idiosyncrasies that require candidates to pitch themselves differently than they would if they were pitching themselves to a national audience.
Does it have a bigger polarizing effect then, with especially with Iowa being first?
Primaries in general have a polarizing effect because they do tend to draw out the more liberal or more conservative, depending on which party you're referring to. And so I would argue that absolutely, in the case of Iowa, it has that effect.
Is it unfair to us here in Wisconsin that we're so late in the process? Do we lose out on our voice in these primary campaigns?
I think it's unfair to a whole lot of states. So definitely it's unfair to Wisconsin. And this has been the way the system has been. And Iowa and New Hampshire have had to bend even a little bit so that South Carolina and Nevada are now part of that conversation about the early states. And that actually always wasn't the case either. And the thing is, Iowa and New Hampshire have really dug in on this and have made threats to the National Party should the National Party try to change things anymore. And so I think if states maybe put more pressure on the National Party, we could see some changes here. But on the flip side, the National Party is trying to have the process go longer, so they've really discouraged states through certain penalties from scheduling their events too close to Iowa, New Hampshire. So there's the states are working at cross purposes, I guess, in the party.
As I understand it, the primary system we have was supposed to be a solution to the smoke-filled rooms where party insiders got together and figured out who to nominate. I don't know. This is a value judgment, obviously, but are we better off now than with the smoke-filled rooms?
That's the same kind of question that I ask my students when I would teach my class on elections and political parties, because you're absolutely right. The idea was to take the power out of the hands of the party leaders to make the process more democratic. And I would argue on its face it's more democratic and that individuals are able to vote, but I would also say that certain individuals have an outsized role in the process, and one of the examples of that would be states that are early versus states that are late.
Some voters are more equal than others.
Right.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
That was Susan Johnson, Assistant Dean and Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She was with us to talk about the role Wisconsin could play in the Republican presidential primary race.
UW-Madison police are sharing a couple of videos that were made to help people prepare for an active shooter situation. The videos were made after the Virginia Tech shooting but were updated in 2013. While they may be uncomfortable to watch, UW-Madison police hope they give people guidelines to help them figure out how they'd behave in a mass shooting situation.
The effort to promote these videos come as gun laws in Wisconsin are facing possible changes. Republican leaders in the state are looking at legislation that would make it illegal to ban guns in UW college buildings.
UW-Madison's chief of police, Susan Reisling, joins us now to talk about the videos and how to improve your safety in an active shooter situation. Chief Reisling, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in one of the videos that you've circulated, you say that you think that if you've thought about this kind of situation even once ahead of time, you can increase your chances of survival. Why do you think it pays to think ahead?
Well, I think with everything in life, you know, if you think it through when you're calm and when you've got some time, you can think through kind of a logic progression. And when you're under tremendous stress and when you're shocked, surprised, and scared, we don't necessarily do our best thinking. And so I think if the students, staff, faculty, and just the public in general, if you think through what would you do if there was a sudden emergency, and it doesn't just have to be active shooter, it can be any number of things, you know, where's your route of escape? Where would you turn for help? What would you physically do? I think if you do that a little bit in advance, you're going to be better off than if it just all takes you by surprise.
It's funny because when I think about this sort of situation, I think, well, you would never know what you could do in that situation. It's so unthinkable. It's not a place that our minds like to go. But you say there are actually things that you can plan. And then maybe in the event that this happens, this is something that you've got a little base knowledge you can work on.
Right. And just as a general safety precaution, I mean, even if we're talking about things like fire, it's always good if you go into a building, a room, a laboratory, you know, where are the exits? How would you get out of there if you needed to in the event of a fire or, you know, any other kind of emergency? And so there are things that you can do. The first thing foremost, if you can get out, that is really, really key. And then what you want to do is be able from a place of safety to call for help and get help, you know, moving towards you. And in certain situations, if you can't get out and you can't call out, depending on what the emergency is, you may need to hide. And then, unfortunately, as things progress, especially in an active shooter situation, if you can do something to delay the perpetrator from getting to you, delay the shooter in an active shooting situation from getting in, keep them away from you, keep them out of your room, make it tougher for them to enter, that's always a good thing. And unfortunately, worst comes to worst, if you're absolutely confronted, you've got no way out, you've got no real other option, then you've got to fight. I think what we have seen over the years is people not understanding that active shooters, those situations, those people are only interested in one thing, and that's killing. And so you can't just sit by. You've got to take some type of action.
And you've got an acronym that you teach in these videos. The acronym is ESCAPE, and you've gone through a lot of that. And let's focus in on the last thing you said. Mm-hmm. If you're stuck, you haven't been able to conceal yourself effectively. Maybe you can't. There's only one door, and you can't get out that door. Fighting back. So what kind of form does that take?
Well, the best way to fight back in those kinds of situations is to do it, hopefully, in concert with others. In other words, what I call the bull rush, literally rushing the shooter is really the most effective way. And we've looked at that. We've seen that, whether that, you know, it was with the Gabby Gifford shooting in Arizona. That's essentially what happened. There were people in that line that had guns, that had concealed carry permits. But the people in the line when Representative Gifford was shot actually all en masse jumped on the shooter and tackled him. And the people with concealed carry permits actually said afterwards, they reholstered and thought, well, I don't know who to shoot, because it was just, you know, as we call it, dog pile. You know, it's just like piling on. And that really is the most effective when you think about 9/11 and the plane that went down in Somerset, Pennsylvania. The way that that happened was a number of passengers formed together and essentially rushed the cockpit of that plane, taking that plane down, and avoided a lot of death on the ground because the target was clearly a building in Washington, D.C.
Now, if barricading the door is a possibility, what does that take? Tell us a little bit more in more detail what that could look like when you've got chaos with a shooter coming down.
Well, I think people, you know, think, well, lock the door. Well, that's a good start. But if the door doesn't have a lock, or, you know, piling up furniture in front of it, simply putting, you know, a binder or a notebook, something underneath the door to make it fit tighter in the door frame. It actually jams the door and makes it very, very difficult to open. You know, in residence halls, we often find students playing jokes on each other where they penny a door, which is, you know, you put a bunch of pennies in the door jamb and you make that door so tight in the jamb that it actually won't open. Highly dangerous in residence halls. Please don't do that. But the point being that, you know, if you've got literally loose pocket change, you can start jamming that into a door jamb and make the door unopenable. And it just delays the shooter, and the more you can delay the shooter, obviously, the more time it is for first responders to get there.
Now, calling 911 is obviously a first step. You got to wait until you are out of harm's way, as reasonable as you can make that. And then when you call 911, what do you need to know about how you should handle that call and what you should tell them?
Well, I think you should tell them what you know. So if you believe you've heard shots fired or you know that shots have been fired, that's what you need to tell them. And if you can give them a description of who it is, obviously where you are is really pretty important. And the big thing is don't assume that somebody else has called. Chances are, today of cell phones, people have called. But the more information that we can get about the way that the suspect is proceeding, the location, the travel, also the behavior is he consistently shooting? Is there interruptions? How many people are injured? All those things are really important for us to know.
And escaping, obviously, is where you start, to get out of the situation, to try to get to safety. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're talking about an airplane scenario, they always say fasten your own mask first. Should you try to help people first, or should you just bolt?
No, you got to bolt. I know that sounds harsh, but the reality of it is that you bolting out and getting out and calling people and giving them good information is going to actually help the people who are already injured. Staying with an injured person when you're in an active shooting situation really is, you're just allowing the person to have another target.
Do you think that UW-Madison is prepared for an active shooter situation? God forbid, but they happen. Are we ready here at UW-Madison?
Well, you know, the first number one thing we need to do is prevent these as much as possible, and we do have a threat team that works on that and does a lot to prevent these things from happening. But secondly, then we do need people to be aware of what's happening and the possibilities. And then finally, you know, we need a rapid response, and we've trained rapid response now for over 16 years. And so I think we are as prepared as we can be. God forbid we're ever tested.
Chief Reisling, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Susan Reisling is the chief of UW-Madison Police. She joined us to talk about how to increase your chance of survival in an active shooting situation.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
There's just a couple few days left until Halloween, so it's your last chance to get out to a haunted house. There are a lot of commercial and nonprofit outfits setting up their own scare factories around the state, and they seem to be getting more elaborate with the sound effects and the special effects and storylines.
But what makes a really good haunted house? Our next guest is a big fan of that genre. He's been to hundreds of haunted houses, and he's been writing reviews for the last couple of seasons. James Causey is an editorial writer and columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, you wrote that you've been to over 300 haunted houses. Why are you such a big fan of being scared and going to haunted houses?
Well, you know, I don't like roller coasters or anything like that, but I do love haunted houses. I just love that fear factor that they provide. And it's just, if you really pay attention to them, they're really unique in their own special way. They offer all the different things and that cause you to challenge yourself, from darkness to sounds to navigating through tight places. It's just, to me, it's the ultimate in giving you that little fear factor.
You know, I'll be upfront about this. I'm a total chicken, so I haven't been to haunted houses since I was a kid, and it sounds like they've gotten kind of sophisticated. What are the elements that go into making a really good haunted house these days?
Oh, God, if you haven't been in years, you need to really check one out, because today's haunted houses are like amusement parks in one location. Oftentimes, they have like two or three different types of haunts at one location. Some offer darkness. Some offer, you know, you go through them, there's an element of actors who really are top-notch. They really play on your fear. They get up in your face. They offer so much. I mean, each haunt is different in its own separate, in its own little way. You know, you may go through areas of darkness. You may have to squeeze through this thing called claustrophobia, where you're actually being squeezed on both ends. You may walk through a vortex in the middle of a haunt. You may have clowns come at you all kinds of ways. There's 3D effects in some of these. I mean, each haunt is so different in its own way, but they are all top-notch, and they give you a little bit of they challenge you in their own way.
I was reading about one that you wrote about where the setup is that this is a zombie apocalypse and you're being sort of fed to these cannibals or zombies as a deal with the government. And there's a line there that I thought was really funny. You wrote, "You were forced to hold a rope and walk as if you were threatened the entire time. I really liked that. So you really liked this experience. What did you like about that?
Well, that was at Hills Have Eyes in Franklin. And one thing that I really liked about that haunt is that it's pretty much all outdoors. And they wanted to even, because they're so dependent upon the weather, they wanted to just add to that element too. So they forced everyone to put on hoods and hold on to this rope. And so and all the while, this drill sergeant is barking out instructions to you, and he has a gun pointed at you as well. You can sort of hear him pulling the trigger and threatening you. And then he tells you, don't let go of that rope. You better not let go of that rope, or I'll put this gun to your head. And then all of a sudden, the rope just disappears out of your hand. And it's like something about that is just like placing you in the scene is just really, really cool. I love that.
And this is something you found really enjoyable. It does sound like you're right there in it. So does that mean to you, James, that the best haunted houses have narratives, that there's a story you're in?
Well, I don't like to say which ones are the best, but what I do like to say is that, you know, you should feel like you're a part of the scene. You should feel like you're that person in the Freddy Krueger movie, and you have like 2 minutes to try to navigate your way out of being killed. So you should feel like you're in that spot and in that element at that one particular moment. And that's what great haunts are like. It's like you're an actor in a scene, and you become a part of this scene. And it's just, that's, who wouldn't like that? You know, because we always watch movies and say, oh, I wouldn't do that. Or why is she doing that? Or why did they fall? Well, placing you in that scene, it shows you how will you react if you're actually placed in that situation.
So do you think you learn stuff about yourself in these haunted houses?
Well, I've been to like over 300, so I've pretty much seen it all. But, you know, the best part, if you are a professional like me, a professional of haunts, go through with like two or three 15-year-old girls and walk behind them, and you'll have the time of your life to see them scream and holler at every single thing. It's pretty fun to watch.
Is there a line between scary and kind of cheesy, kind of campy?
I think, you know, it used to be. Where you would go to a haunt and you'd be like, oh, that was pretty terrible. But today's haunts, they all share similar elements because they all go to the same haunt factories and they get all the latest gimmicks and stuff and they try to bring them back to their haunts. So that they all pretty much follow similar themes. But no one is, you know, they charge you a lot of money. I mean, you could pay on, you know, from $13 on up to like $50 for going to a haunted house. So they got to give you your money's worth. So they're always challenging themselves. And the best haunts, they have their actors talk after every week or every night and talk about how they can make it better. Because if you keep things the same, people just won't come to you and you lose a ton of money. So you have to constantly change things. So it's not campy. I think they often try to improve themselves over and over again.
We're talking with James Causey right now of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the appeal of haunted houses, and James is talking about some of the scariest stuff he's seen this time around. And so, James, what is some of the scariest stuff? We mentioned sort of the hanging onto the rope and the drill sergeant barking orders and fleeing, you know, through tiny claustrophobic spaces. What are some of the other scariest things that you went through this time around?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that I really like. You know, some people don't like the spook factor where someone just comes from a tight place and gets in your face and like, ah, you got to have a little bit of that. You got to have a little bit of darkness. And when I say a little bit of darkness, that means like you feel like you're in a dark place for like up to like 10 minutes and you can't figure your way out. You have to have great actors. They make or break an entire haunt. And then you have to have something that makes you unique. What makes you different than any other haunted house out there? And what I added to my haunt reviews this year is, what makes you unique? What makes you different than anyone else? And everybody that answered that question, they all had something that made them unique. You know, for instance, there's Spooky Stalks, for instance. They have, you know, 8-foot-tall corn stalks in right in back of you. So you walk through a cornfield, which is pretty unique and different in its own way. You know, then you have the haunt in Waukesha, where you have 3 or 4 haunts in one. And then what they added this year is this whole thing where you have to, you know, you go in groups of 10 and you have to figure out this puzzle. You have like 50 minutes to figure it out to get these keys so you can get out before this monster is released on you. Hmm. So it's that element. You know, so each one has something that makes it unique. The Hills Have Eyes, for instance, they have a ski lift. I mean, what's better than going through a ski lift in the middle of the night after going through like all these haunted houses and you taking a ski lift? I mean, it's like picturesque, it's beautiful and scary at the same time. So they all offer something different. And then, you know, it was this new haunt called Siege Haunt, where it's like it was their first year, and what they had was paintball. You know, you're shooting paintball guns at zombies in the woods. I mean, that was a total something totally different. But what I liked about it is that, you know, I could see where they're going with this, and I could tell you, like, 2 years from now or 3 years from now, it's going to really be good. But, you know, they try something different as a paintball factory, and they say, hey, let's get in on a haunt. On a hunt money and see if we could make it. So they had these creatures coming out of the woods, and you're on the back of a trailer and you're shooting paintballs at them in the middle of the night. That was pretty fantastic. So they all offer something different.
Which one was that, the paintball one?
That was Siege. It was Siege Paintball. And that one was, I got to go through my mental, my mental vortex to see if I can remember. Siege was in Maguanago. Siege Scare Factory. And then there was Terror on Rural Street in Hartford, which is really cool. And what I like the most about that is it's an all-volunteer haunt. The sets, the actors, everybody there volunteers, and the money goes towards the Hartford High School, you know, for scholarships and things like that. And that haunt, it's in its 16th year, and I've been going there for probably, I remember when they first opened, and it's probably the most improved haunt on this year's tour. I mean, it was absolutely fantastic, and they typically have been big on animatronics, but this year they had a perfect mix of animatronics and actors and scenes and things like that that blew me away.
So, James, for someone like me who hasn't been in a while, or someone who's kind of a fraidy cat, again, like me, can you give me a quick encouragement for going to one of these things this year?
Yeah, have fun. Have fun. Wear comfortable shoes.
Comfy shoes.
I have some
check.
Do's and don'ts on haunts. Wear comfortable shoes. Don't wear high heels, ladies, because you're going to be going. Sometimes you have to crawl in some of these haunts, and some of them are kind of dirty and dusty, so don't wear your best clothes. Make sure you don't wear expensive jewelry that you could lose, because if it falls out in the haunted house, it's gone forever. Mm-hmm. And just make sure you just have fun. Don't drink too much before you go. I've been to some where people had a little bit too much to drink and they get pretty obnoxious, especially in like bag mazes where they can't figure left from right, and then they're stuck in these places for a long period of time. So just go have fun and just be prepared to be scared.
James, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
That was James Causey, editorial writer and columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your holiday traditions. Call in or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you go to haunted houses or even work in one? Are you lost in the maze right now? Do you go all out with your yard decorations or your costume for the year? Hey, what are you going to be this weekend? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Halloween is coming up, and we want to hear about your traditions for the holiday. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You can answer questions like this. Are you going to dress up? What is your costume? Do you go to haunted houses like our last guest? Do you host a party of some sort? Call 800-642-1234.
What about a scary movie night? Do you have a favorite one that you like to watch? Do you do it alone so you're super spooked out? Or do you do it with your friends and your family? You can call us right now, 800-642-1234.
Go right to our callers. Danny is on the line with us in Marinette. Danny, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Yeah, a good haunted house would be in Green Bay is Terror on the Fox at the National Railroad Museum. They have a thing where you can get on board the train and have artists dressed up in costumes and stuff on the train, and the train takes you around to the other side of the museum, and then they have the haunted house set up where you walk through the woods and that. It's a pretty good place.
So the train itself isn't set up as a haunted train, is it?
Yep. You board the train, and the train takes you around to the other side of the National Railroad Museum where they have the haunted house set up.
So haunted train and haunted house. What a great idea, Danny. That's the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay.
It's called Terror on the Fox. They have a website and everything for it.
Danny, thanks so much for getting us started. That sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, not just your standard haunted house, but a train ride.
The train ride sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Danny, at 800-642-1234, looking for your Halloween traditions, your favorites.
And let's go next to Jesse joining us in Sparta. Jesse, hi.
Hi.
What is your tradition?
Well, it's a recent tradition. I started volunteering with the Unalaska JCs for their haunted house, and we started doing it last year in conjunction with our nonprofit as well. And we've been doing like event staff detail for them, and all I have to say is that it's amazing what these teenagers do. The entire house is constructed, designed, imagined by high school students that belong to the JCs, and they work the entire year around building the rooms, creating their characters, making their costumes, and it's just amazing in October to see everything come together and to help the kids work on their character development, their scare tactics, seeing which new rooms come up
wow.
every year. It is a blast, and every year I am increasingly more and more proud of these kids for all the work that they put on, and we have had a huge weekend last weekend, and I'm just so excited to see what Halloween weekend brings for them. It's my favorite house in the area, but I might be a little biased.
So, Jesse, it sounds like it changes every year. Every year is a little bit different.
Most definitely. It's always at the same location, but the theme for the rooms always change depending on what the kids want to do and what the overall theme of the house is. This year, it's kind of a Fearwater Farm where freaks go when they're not on the freak sideshow. So it's more like freaks in the off-season, if you will. Or
freaks in the off-season. Okay, good. Well, thank you so much for calling and telling us about it.
We are taking your calls with your Halloween plans. We want to know, what's your costume? Are you having a party? Are you going to go to a haunted house? Do you work at a haunted house? And hey, maybe what is your favorite Halloween candy, the one you have to make sure you get rid of or you're going to eat it all the next day? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Dana with us in Two Rivers. Dana, hi.
Hey there. I wanted to give a shout out to an excellent haunted house. My husband and I travel around to different haunted houses. We go to at least two or three each year. And the burial chamber in, I believe it's Nina, in the Appleton area, was top-notch, excellent, worth every penny. They did an excellent job of every scaring all your senses and just very professional and worth every hour traveled.
So Dana, you go to two or three haunted houses a year. You said, why do you like haunted houses so much?
Oh, they're so fun. It gets your blood pumping. And I love Halloween. We don't have any kids, and it's kind of a way to just kind of get silly. And I love putting weird things, you know, eyeballs in the bathroom. And it's just, you know, it's just fun to do fun stuff. So.
All right, Dana, thank you so much. We'll have fun at the remaining haunted houses this season.
Dana, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234 as we talk about your favorite things to do to be scared on Halloween. We're going to go next to George in Waukesha. George, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good, thanks. How about you?
Good, thank you.
Well, what did you want to bring up for your favorite scare factor at Halloween?
So I'm going to take my kid and his friends to CMH Haunted House in Waukesha.
Okay, Haunted House in Waukesha. Have you been before?
No, first time.
And so have you ever been to any haunted houses before?
No, actually, no.
So you're you'd be a first-timer. That would be me if I ever actually did that. Are you worried about being too scared?
No, not really.
All right, well, you sound like you're going to have a good time with your kids. Well, thank you so much, George, for calling.
George, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Bill with us in Platteville. Bill, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, it's never happened before as far as I know, but starting this year, the Mining Museum in Platteville is going to have a haunted mine from 6 to 9 p.m.
Do they have actually part of an old mine that this is going to be in, or is it a recreation of a mine?
No, it is an old mine.
Wow.
And it's open to the public during the summer anyway, but it's going to be open this year for Halloween.
Are you going to go, or are you going to check it out yourself?
I don't know.
Not a fan of getting scared?
Well, I'm not a fan of the steps to go down into the mine.
Oh, okay. Well, Bill, thank you so much. What a great idea, taking advantage of that mining history and mining landscape and building a haunted house in that. Bill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234.
And we're going to go next to Teresa in Hales Corners. Hi there.
Hi.
What are you going to do to scare yourself on Halloween?
Well, I wanted to pick up on a previous caller talking about the Catholic Memorial Haunted House in Waukesha.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the building itself has kind of an ominous history behind it and is believed to perhaps actually be haunted.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of cool. But the rooms change every year, and it's all student-driven. It's the students at Catholic Memorial that design the rooms and staff the rooms. And all proceeds go to veterans issues every year because that's the memorial and Catholic Memorial. So this year it's going to, I believe it's called Camp Hero, you know, the camp for kids of veterans. And in the past it's sponsored honor flights and Wounded Warriors. So it's just a really cool thing that the kids are, you know, running it, designing it, and giving back to the community.
So this one is in Waukesha, and our caller George was going to take his kids. Is this a kid-appropriate thing to do you think, Teresa?
They do have, if you go on the Catholic Memorial Facebook page, all the details will be there. But an hour early is a kid-friendly time. I think it's at 6 o'clock. And this would be the last weekend that it runs, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But
okay.
I believe at 6 o'clock is the kid hour, and then 7 o'clock for general admission.
All right, good to know. Well, thank you so much for calling with that.
Well, our next caller at 800-642-1234. It's not sundown yet, but we have evidently Dracula in Door County. Dracula, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your, I don't even know if I want to know, what's your Halloween tradition, Dracula?
Well, I like to enjoy hot chocolate with my family. Here in Door County, where the lovely colors of the leaves are changing now.
Unexpectedly wholesome, Dracula.
Yes. Well, this is radio, after all.
All right, Dracula, thank you so much. So it is a fun family evening, I find, you know, giving out candy on the front porch. Of course, by nighttime when people are trick-or-treating, you can't see the colors. But Door County, that would be a lovely place to do that.
Yes,
definitely.
Yes. Who knew Dracula was there? I was just there. I had no idea. I would have been more scared had I known.
Right. Yeah, you were just up there.
Mm-hmm.
Wait.
Well.
You are wearing a turtleneck.
I don't like where this is going, so I'm going to take another call. Let's go to Ralph in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi there.
Hi. My tradition is that when my children were little, I would always go through their bags when they got home and check them, make sure everything was copacetic. And then I would relieve them of all their Snicker bars, old little Snicker ones. And that carried on to my grandkids. So if I happened to be, and as many times was, with my grandkids, I did the same thing. And now that I'm no longer with them and they're all older and so forth, they still save their Snicker bars for Grandpa.
Oh, that's nice. Good tradition. So they're not too bitter about you taking all. I think of the Snickers as some of the best parts of the Halloween candy that you could possibly get. So those and Reese's. I'm with you on stealing that. Congratulations on having grandkids who love you a lot enough to save the Snickers.
That is great. Yeah, so the candy selection, I did the shopping this year. I bought probably too much variety, and I think the goal is going to be to get the Reese's out the door fast, because those are the ones I will keep eating.
Wrong. What you need
around.
To do is put those aside and take them into the office on Monday.
Is it? Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, no, I will end up sharing something with coworkers. I don't want that last minute ride to the store to restock, though. So I tend to overbuy a little bit. Do you give out the candy at your house? That's usually my role.
Well, normally we do that. This year, we're actually going to be going somewhere to trick or treat.
Uh-huh.
So I'll be out and about with the rest of the ghouls and goblins.
Costume?
Usually I'm an egg. And my husband is bacon, but I don't know. We can't find our costume. So who knows? It's anybody's game.
You've lost the egg and bacon. I usually don't plan on doing anything and then really halfway, a half effort, something together with a funny hat or
Legolas
something.
Legolas the elf? No?
Yeah, I could do up my hair like that top. Yeah, that
There's
thing.
There's a little resemblance
Maybe.
There.
Maybe. Get a little bow and arrow.
All right. Well, fun stuff. Everybody have a great Halloween.
Thanks for sharing your plans. You can keep it going, by the way, at the Central Time Facebook page.